Welcome to the Apologia podcast, the audio-only archive of the Apologia YouTube channel. Note that some content was designed to go with visuals, but the imagination can be a powerful thing. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider giving it a 5-star rating on the podcast app you're using now to help us reach more people. Or, since this endeavor is ad-free, consider going a step further and supporting us for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/apologia. But for now, let's get to the episode, part of the Apologetic series, posted February 6, 2023, titled Christians Vote, Was Mark Mark? Featuring Dr. James Tabor, Mike Lacona response.
You can distrust what the Gospel of Mark reports.
I can and I do.
But you shouldn't use the arguments against the traditional authorship of Mark.
Oh.
And that he got his information from Peter.
Why not?
You probably shouldn't use those because this is the position of the majority of critical scholars today by a 2-to-1 ratio.
Oh.
It's not just my opinion. We took a vote.
We took a vote, Mom.
You got to respect the vote.
Welcome to Apologia, where a former Christian takes a look at the claims of Christians.
I know you do a lot with apologetics, so-called, and boy, it's well-named apologetics. It's actually a field where I'm studying apologetics. I'm getting my PhD in apologetics, and you go like, what? It's not an academic field. You know, it's just crazy because it implies that you've already got your conclusion and now you're defending the faith.
Today, I'm joined by renowned Bible scholar, Dr. James Tabor, former professor of ancient Judaism and early Christianity at UNC Charlotte. Now retired, but bringing his academic level work to everyone, including an amazing online course on the Book of Mark that we're going to talk about later in the video.
I taught actually 43 years and at Catholic University, William and Mary, and then UNC Charlotte. Most of my students were of evangelical backgrounds or they wouldn't be taking a Bible course. However, the evangelicals ended up loving the Mark course and the historical Jesus because they learned so much about the text that they could then apply in their own faith way. But at least they learned to read the text critically. And I could just tell they couldn't wait to go out and like put some of this in their Bible studies and their lessons because it was really cool stuff that nobody else had told them about. And so I would like to bridge the gap between careful study and people being so defensive about, well, what are you trying to either disprove or prove? Nothing. I'm just looking at a document and asking what we can know about it. I mean, if you want to refute something I say based on lack of evidence, why would it have to be defending any faith or not faith? It would just be like Tabor's wrong on that because he says 1, 2, 3, and actually check this point and this point and this point, and they don't hold up. But they've made it into this thing that's like putting the walls around the church and we're going to defend the faith. Picture guys with jousting poles and armor and, you know, defending the faith.
Well, speaking of defending the faith, today we're taking a look at another Bible scholar regular viewers will be familiar with, Dr. Mike Lacona.
Well, Mike, I know only from YouTube. I've never met him and I've seen some of his videos and I think he debated Bart Ehrman at one point. I listened to some of that.
Hi, I'm joined today with a former student of mine, Joshua Pelletier. And Joshua was one of my students at Houston Baptist University, took a couple of my courses, really a sharp student, and he wanted to do a master's thesis. So I suggested some of the prolegomena or preliminary matters related to the Gospel of Mark.
And it started off with looking at what majority of critical scholars say on Mark's dating, his source, such as was Peter connected, and authorship. And I took on a fourth topic, the origin of Mark's gospel.
His student, Josh, did a good job for a student, I thought. I don't know him at all. He had a real workmanship test to do, which is okay for grads. You know, go through, collect 200 and whatever references and check it all out. And you're just going to see what everybody said about dating, authorship, attribution to Peter, and so forth about Mark. So he's basically just tallying it up.
We're talking about what we're going to be discussing here for these three episodes, these three videos, is where critical scholars are. Critical scholars They have a PhD published in the relevant field of New Testament studies.
One of the caveats I had in listening is the definition of a critical scholar. It had nothing to do with methodology. It was simply a PhD degree, and you publish in the field of New Testament. Well, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, I consider it unfortunate. The Society of Biblical Literature, and this has been lamented by others, has been largely not taken over as much as overwhelmed by evangelical scholars with PhDs. Now, are they critical scholars? Well, they have degrees. But remember, you can get an accredited PhD from an evangelical school that has a statement of faith that says the Bible is the inerrant word of God.
Was we start at a date of 1965. 1965 until present is the sources that were sampled. And because I'm not able to translate French or German or any other language yet, all sources that were used were sources that were written in English language.
How many scholars, individual scholars, were included in your survey?
I sample a total of 207 scholars.
So the first thing in terms, whenever a student has a project like this, you have to talk about method. Okay, there's nothing wrong with the method, ostensibly, of going through literature and tallying up what English writers from a certain period have said about a subject. It's data. This could be interesting. The way it's used, though, by Mike Lacuna, and ostensibly Josh is taking it this way too, is, wow, there's a pretty good consensus out there by critical scholars because they have PhDs, so they would know that 2-1. It's written by a guy named Mark. They don't have any other name to offer. And he probably hung out with Peter. So we could be getting Peter's reflections here, dating around 70, whether it's a little before, during, or after. I'm not going to quibble with that.
It's essentially the majority of scholars believe, about 98 scholars believe that the dating was 70 or earlier for the Gospel of Mark. It's a little over 61%, yes.
Now, I would fault the method because you're not defining well what you mean by critical scholars. Well, actually, they do define it. I shouldn't say you're not defining it. You define it in such a way that it tells you nothing. The real question when you evaluate what scholars say, two things. One is, what are their presuppositions that they're bringing to the question? If the presupposition is that the New Testament Gospels are inspired by God, and all we're really talking about is who God used to do it, then that's one thing to make clear. And I assume that is the presupposition. But to call that critical is a stretch, because you would have already decided before that it's inerrant.
When Dr. Lacuna is looking at resurrection minimal facts, or historical bedrock, as he calls it, he's looking for heterogeneous scholarship, that there are significant non-believing scholars who agree with the evangelical ones on a given point.
By far, the majority of scholars who grant the empty tomb are Christian scholars. So it didn't quite make a strong enough majority, and it's certainly not a robust heterogeneity of scholarship that is granting it. So,
unfortunately, Mike seems to have abandoned that here.
You're saying the conclusion is the majority of critical scholars since 1965 think that the traditional authorship of Mark is correct.
Yes.
Okay.
What he's apparently thrilled about, and what Mike is ecstatic about, that there's a 2-1 ratio of critical scholars saying that Mark might really be Mark, meaning the guy mentioned in the book of Acts that we know absolutely nothing about, but was a companion of Paul according to Acts. He's never mentioned in Paul's letters, his genuine letters, so we really don't know, but he's out there. He probably did exist. Who knows? We don't know anything about the guy, but he seems thrilled with that tally. Well, if it's inerrant, even Mark, according to Papias, the church historian or father around the year 100, says that he got it from Peter. And if he got it from Peter, you know, it must be pretty good. Plus God inspired it. And so there's just a whole pile of what I would call almost triumphant presupposition.
So here we go again. It's a little better than a 2-1 ratio in favor of Petrine connection versus not a Petrine connection.
They're triumphant in the sense that you feel this celebration, like, yay, 2-1. scholars are agreed that Mark wrote Mark and that he knew Peter, and it's basically Peter's memoirs. The other thing you have to do, this is just scholarly method, and I insist on it with my students, and you need to be careful about this with students, is that it really doesn't matter how many people say this or that. What matters is what is their argumentation that leads them to those conclusions. And lots of times when people are writing on Mark, there's several commentaries on Mark, and some of the better ones that are more critical, more historical critical, coming from scholars at major universities that would be considered mainstream in terms of the critical approach to early Christianity, like Joel Marcus, not to just mention him, but he teaches at Duke, and he's written really a definitive multi-volume work on Mark. And of course, he's going to go through all of those arguments about, you know, Papias. You have to do that when you do authorship, and it was attributed to Peter in the early church and so forth. But I don't remember now offhand without looking what Marcus says about authorship, but my guess is, would be he is mainly recording what the traditional view was and probably ends up among that minority in the tally that says, you know, we really don't know. That would be my guess. I'm not sure. We could check. But whether, you know, I just named him because he did one of the main commentaries on Mark. I think it's the Anchor Bible, two volumes. So you see what I'm saying about method. You have to be very careful with that. Now, what you really should do, if you're going to talk about this question, it's fine to tally the material, but the program should be, what are the strong arguments for the questions that you're addressing? What are the strong arguments? Not like raise your hand if you think this or that, because lots of times the majority is wrong. That happens all the time in scholarship, where people who take votes don't necessarily come up with what later is understood to be the case.
But what are some of the evidences, the external evidences? You started to mention some of these, that John Mark wrote the gospel.
The external evidence, which is primarily church tradition. You have Papias, Irenaeus, you have Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian, Origen, Jerome.
What would you say to the person that really all we really have is Papias on this. The others just got their information from Papias. So you only really have one source. What would you say?
Well, I was telling the burn proofs on them.
Well, the one reference that Josh brings up and Mike talks about and everybody knows is this Bishop Papias. And he's preserved primarily by Eusebius. I've got my Eusebius right here, and I put a little marker in it to read to you. And what it, now remember, this is Eusebius, a fourth century historian, reporting what he says Papias would say. He says, Mark became Peter's interpreter and wrote accurately all that he remembered, not indeed in order. Well, that's kind of interesting. Did somebody else write in order? I guess that would be Luke, who said, I'm putting it in order. So he probably knows that. And what does he say? He says he's following Peter, who used to give teaching as necessity demanding, but not making it arranged as the Lord's oracles, so that Mark did nothing wrong in writing down single points as he remembered them. Now, this doesn't sound like inspiration for one thing. So to quote, here's the earliest witness is saying, what I've gotten is that a guy named Mark just kind of put some stuff down the best he could as he remembered. Okay. And he gave attention to leave out nothing of what he had heard and make no false statements. Well, this is just, and then actually Eusebius goes on to say really poor things about Papias because he believes in a literal millennium and 1,000 years on earth. And he goes, well, he's not a very smart guy. He says that about him. He says, this Papias guy, he's not very smart because Eusebius had a more spiritual view of the kingdom being the church. And so to go to Papias, who's preserved primarily by this fourth century writer, and have this kind of shaky chain of connection back to Peter, that's where it all comes from. It's basically what I just wrote you. So is that evidence really? I think that's coming from the fact, and it is mentioned in the video quite a bit, that in the letter attributed to Peter, he does mention somebody called my son Mark. Well, first of all, that wouldn't mean it was the Mark of the book of Acts, right? Secondly, the book of Acts is pretty late. So whoever that Mark was, we don't know anything about him. And to suddenly put him in Asia, hanging out with Papias, getting all this material from Peter, it's just this house of cards in terms of any sort of historical attribution. I don't think we know who wrote any of the Gospels, even Luke Acts, because he doesn't give his name. He writes for Theophilus. Matthew, we don't know. That actually is also on the same page. And Matthew collected the oracles in the Hebrew language and interpreted them as best he could. Then again, these claims, right? This is my Eusebius I'm holding here, actually make no reference to any kind of inspiration or even kind of inerrancy or anything. You're remembering things as best you can and interpreting things as best you can. I really wonder sometimes why people quote them. And then Eusebius goes on to say that he's not a very smart guy. It's not very convincing. And, you know, for me, what do I gain if a student asks me, well, Dr. Tabor, do you think Mark wrote Mark? And what do I gain by saying yes or no? Think about it. What do I gain? If I say yes, it's like, well, oh, wow, you do. You think Mark wrote it? Well, I would want to say to the student, who's Mark? Mark is a very common name. I think you've heard of the Emperor Marcus Aurelius. It's a common name in the second century and earlier. It's a very common, how about Mark Antony? It's a very common name. So Mark wrote it. Well, who's Mark? Oh, there's a Mark mentioned in Acts. Maybe it's him. Look, wait, maybe it's him? So even if Papias did say, and I think maybe he did, I mean, Eusebius seems to be quoting, that Mark wrote it. Who's Mark? Says, oh, he's a companion of Peter. Really? Peter dies in the 60s. Papias is not a companion of Peter. He's a follower, maybe. Most people put Papias's birth in the 60s. So he's not hanging out with Peter. But supposedly there's this other chain through the elder John who knew Peter, becomes, I think, three times removed. And then if you add that he's not very smart, which is my favorite line. So what do you really gain? You have a name. Why not read the work and then decide? See, I get the idea that Mike and Josh and all the people of their approach are trying to somehow work towards authenticity, inspiration, and maybe even a kind of inerrancy, because this came apostolically passed down. But if you look at the broken links of how it passed down, it's not building much confidence. These phrases about as he remembered, as he arranged them. And then it's also defensive, like he didn't do anything wrong in writing them down as he remembered them. This is Mark, as he remembered them. So apparently, you know, it's just, I don't see what's gained by it.
What are some of the arguments for an early date of Mark? Let's say pre-70, 70 being that date when the Jerusalem temple was destroyed.
There's lots of dealings with Mark 13, a lot of disputes. And so there's various arguments to try to show that Mark 13 represents, this time of conflict. So they might talk about the Neronian persecution or Caligula or something like that. And so that's used to try to date for 80-70 timeframe. Mark 13 can be used to try to date a before 70 as well as a after 70.
Now, you mentioned Mark 13 a couple of times. Just this is Jesus' Olivet Discourse, in which he's predicting when the temple is going to be destroyed and the second coming and things like this, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I think God's been laying my heart to try and look at Mark 13, try to see if there's a dating that can be established, whether it be pre-factum or post-factum of the temple, based on an exegesis of that.
I do think that Mark 13 is a key because it reflects a situation of the author. He even addresses the reader the only time directly in Mark 13, let the reader understand. And so he is referring to that he intends, and that's Mark, not Jesus. Jesus doesn't stop and say, let the reader understand. You know, that's Mark. So we actually have a note from the author saying, be sure you get this. The sign of the coming is when you see the desolating sacrilege standing where it should not be. That seems to be, of course, it goes back to Daniel 9, which does predict that a ruler will come and destroy the city and the sanctuary. So you could get the bare idea without being prophetic, you know, some expectation that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. But because he addresses the reader and then talks about the tribulation and trials that are coming and how you have to be faithful, but it's going to come soon. And the last word of Mark 13 is watch, as be ready, be vigilant, don't go to sleep. If a thief is coming to rob you, you stay up all night sitting in front of the door with your shotgun, I guess, because you're not going to be surprised and go to sleep. So I think that captures enough of the post-70 destruction of Jerusalem context, where things have been shattered, people are wondering, when is the end coming? And he's able to put it all together into a package in which people realize you're going to go through suffering. He went through suffering. That's what's going to really count. But in the end, we will triumph, but only if we go through the suffering and stay vigilant. It's the message that he ends with. I would put it, 70s, but do you realize, and I think you do, that all of this dating is just so arbitrary. If you look at the textbook thing, just take Bart Ehrman's textbook, which is the most widespread out there, or any of them. It's like, okay, Mark is 70, Matthew is 80, Luke is 90, and John is 100. That's almost like, and you go like, oh, really? Why would you skip 10 years for every gospel? Just because you got to space them out. But there's no objective way to date some of these. Now, people have tried sometimes to say things, and I think Josh mentions this to his credit.
Christopher Zeichman, he talks about the denarii and how that wasn't in circulation, and that you or the people, the audience that Mark was writing to didn't pay taxes either. And so he dates Mark no earlier than August 29 of 71, because that's when Vespasian came into power and they started paying the taxes.
Oh, well, what about the tribute that in the temple? Doesn't that reflect a kind of post-temple idea of paying tribute and so forth? So those things can be looked at. And I think it probably does, even though I haven't personally studied that issue very thoroughly. I would go to Crossan's book, on the tribute, because he wrote a whole book on it recently, Don Crossan. But I would put it in the 70s, but more than whether it's before or after the destruction of Jerusalem, and could Jesus be a prophet? That's not the issue.
I've seen a couple scholars talk about how prophecies are not true, or that Mark was just purely writing fiction. I think the majority of scholars who do a post-70, they start off by attacking the patristic data. But I don't see too much of a bias, honestly, at least not admitted.
Josephus writes the Jewish War in 73, I believe, 73 to 75, I'm trying to remember, right after the destruction. It would be a contemporary kind of work to Mark. And so you probably want to read something like the Jewish War. And you do find in the Jewish War that Josephus hints, based on Daniel, a very important passage in Book 6 of the Jewish War, he says that we should have known this was coming because of Daniel. I think Mark's saying the same thing. We should have known this was coming because of Daniel 9, that the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary until desolation is poured out on the desolator. So where are we? We're in that word until. He came, that would be Vespasian and Titus, destroyed the city and the sanctuary. That's in Daniel 9. Now, I think they're talking about Antiochus Epiphanes historically, right? And then desolation is poured out on the desolator and so forth, the 70 weeks prophecy. But if you're going to project it forward into the first century, you can see what a nice fit it is. So where is Mark living? He's living with the word until. And when is God going to pour out wrath upon the desolator? That is the Romans. Very soon. And that's why he tells Pontius Pilate, the high priest, you will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven, meaning we're going to be glorified. Our group is going to be glorified. You guys are going down. So it's a passion narrative. It's an apocalyptic passion narrative with a short introduction. That's really what Mark is. The passion narrative, meaning the suffering. It's also, I would say, and I think this is really important, it's the first Jewish document, and I would call it Jewish. I mean, God of Israel, Shema, keep the commandments to be saved. And by the way, when Jesus is asked, what do I do to have eternal life? He doesn't say, believe on me and be saved. He says, keep the commandments. So just follow the Torah. And the guy goes, oh, I've done that. He goes, well, then sell what you have, meaning you got to sacrifice. But anyway, I think Mark is the first Jewish document to emerge from the post-war period, proposing a way to follow the God of Israel after the destruction of the temple. And that's why in Mark 7, what do we do about this? What do we do about ritual purity? What do we do about washing of hands? And he has that polemic against the temple where the wise scribe, the only one commended in the entire Gospel of Mark, not named. All the heroes of Mark are not named. It's never the apostles. It's three women, unnamed, and the wise scribe. And what does he say? Yeah, if you love God and love your neighbor as yourself, that would be more than all these burnt offerings and sacrifices. So he's essentially already proposing what the Pharisees end up saying, that, you know, really God needs our intention, our kavanah, to obey him. These sacrifices were added because of our transgressions, and they're really not central to what true religion is all about. And now for the past 2,000 years, we've had forms of Judaism that have predominated, in which you don't need to have the sacrificial system for the religion to work just fine. Mark is the first one, I think, to propose that, which is very important historically to note.
And I took on a fourth topic, the origin of Mark's gospel.
So in these videos, Mike never gets around to Josh's fourth thesis topic on Mark, the origin and purpose of the book. What's your take on Mark?
It basically is trying to honor the author's intent as much as we can, not to use it to do something else, but to let Mark be Mark. Because I'm of the firm opinion that Matthew and Luke did not like Mark. So even though it makes it in, and it's their main source in each case, like 90% of Mark appears in Matthew, but it's very, very edited and rewritten, and about 85% in Luke. So they're using it for sure. It's very valuable to them. But I would say they're abusing it. And by that, I mean they're taking it completely differently than Mark presented it. The main thing is that for Mark, it's a mystery and an enigma and a riddle. And you, the reader, are the view, you're the observer. You're the omniscient observer of this drama. So think of a play. You're told the secret in line one, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's the secret. Then when the story starts, it's like somebody going, they don't know. These people don't know. And then you start watching things happen, like Jesus comes and meets John the Baptist and he's baptized and so forth and so on. So who knows Jesus? Well, the spirits know Jesus and they're told to shut up repeatedly. Do not say, I'm the Son of God. So you're reading along and then Jesus teaches in riddles. And I know when I was growing up in Sunday school, that's to help the people understand. And Mark just literally says, no, I'm teaching in riddles or parables, as it's called in Greek, so that people won't understand. And only those with eyes to see and ears to hear and a heart to understand will get it. And the rest of you won't. And as you go through, you start realizing, wow, that includes the disciples and the 12. He constantly tells them, you don't get this. You don't get this. If you don't get this, how are you going to get anything? And when you finally reach the climax of the book, which is halfway through chapter 8, and Jesus is ready to head for Jerusalem to die. You finally get to chapter 8, and the truth is out. Peter says, you are the Christ. And then Jesus tells about his suffering. Peter rebukes Jesus and says, don't tell anyone. But Peter rebukes Jesus. I assume he said, like, no, no, no. We're talking about the power and the glory that we're all going to have in the kingdom. And then Jesus says to him, get behind me, Satan. So the most shocking thing I say in the course, I guess, for people, and I did it in some of the promos and people just got very upset, is that Peter's confession of Jesus as the Christ is satanic. Now, yeah, I did that partly for attention. I want my students to wake up. What did he say? But I'm not saying it. Jesus is saying it. When Jesus basically rebukes Peter, I would say curses him. Get behind me, Satan. That's pretty rough coming from Jesus. Luke just takes that out. Can you believe that? Just takes it out. Just not there. And what does Matthew do? Matthew's more conservative. He leaves it in and then puts a blessing on Peter to be head of the church so that it's like, oh, he didn't quite get it, but glory, hallelujah. He's the rock upon which the church is built. So clearly they do not like Mark and they have to override it and kind of get rid of it, I would say. So critical means careful. And if you take this course, you're going to carefully read Mark as Mark. Not with the purpose of proving anything. It's not a faith enterprise in that sense. It's a historical investigation. What does this document contribute to our understanding of earliest Christianity as it was emerging, what we call Christian origins? Mark clearly wants to say to his reader, are you getting this or not? You know, where are you? Are you following along or are you like the disciples? Well, most of my evangelical readers or people even who've taken the course, usually it's people that don't take the course. They just listen to the promo and then they go like, oh, well, he said Peter's confession was satanic. How could anybody say that without even listening? And but if your understanding is wrong, and theirs was, and then they all forsook him and fled, and they never get anything right, then basically Mark is saying to the reader, what about you? And the only true confession of Jesus in the whole book is by a Roman centurion when Jesus is dead on the cross. And that's the last view of Jesus in Mark. Where's the glory hallelujah? He breathes his last. And what does he say? My God, why have you forsaken me? And then he's dead. Well, that raises questions even today with people like, well, what does that mean? You see, did God forsake him? Mark's leaving you with that. That's the last scene. Curtain goes down. And when the curtain goes up again, empty tomb, he's gone. And the women run away and say nothing to anyone. And you have got to then figure it out as the reader. Now, this is not the kind of message, the easy to understand, almost like a catechism or primer for early Christianity. This is a puzzle. So that if you want to say Jesus is the Christ, fine. But what is it that you're really affirming? And Mark is very concerned about that. I think it's somewhat parallel to Paul, who often talks in his letters about his suffering and how he bears in his body the marks of Jesus and so forth, over against some of his opponents that are going for the glory and visions and all kinds of things that they've seen. And he addresses that. So it could be that Mark has the same kind of interest. And he also has, well, you asked me more questions, but one of the things people say, well, does Mark have a high or a low Christology, which is very theological to even phrase it like that. I would just say, what's his view of Jesus? Well, clearly the secret is he's the Christ, the Son of God. But what does that mean? And he's also referred to as the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven. But I think for Mark, that is the triumph of the people of God, not just Jesus. And probably the best passage on his Christology is chapter 10, where somebody calls him good rabbi. And he goes, why are you calling me good? There's only one good God. And he essentially quotes what Jews call the Shema, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. Also quotes it later in the Gospel of Mark. And so Mark's gospel stands out when he talks about the Sabbath and how to obey the Sabbath and follow the Sabbath in Mark chapter 2, which Matthew has to completely rewrite because it's so shocking. He says the Sabbath is made for humans, not humans for the Sabbath. Therefore, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Well, as you know, Son of Man can be human being. That's what it means originally in Daniel 7. I saw a human being in the throne room of God, which shouldn't be. How can there be a human being there? And the vision is then interpreted as the people of God, not the Messiah, Daniel 7. And I think Mark Moore has that view. The Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven is not Jesus returning, but the idea that human beings that follow this way of suffering will finally be glorified. It's a kind of, and that would be the interpretation right out of Daniel. You know, why do you call me good? There's none good but God. He does have authority, he says, on earth to forgive sins and heal, and Mark has miracles of Jesus. But this is just the divine man idea. Judaism has other figures in its history, even at this time, of people who could, Honi the circle drawer is the best known from the Galilee. Stops it from raining, just like Elijah. Doesn't mean you're God. Elijah's not God. Moses isn't God. They did miracles. And this world, if you're approved by God, you do these extraordinary miracles, but he does not allow somebody to call him God or worship him. So Mark is a troublesome document. And in this course, I show that. It's a real problem. Unless you go with it and try to listen to Mark as Mark. See, everybody's hearing the other gospels in their head. Because all our lives, if you've gone to churches or been exposed to Christianity, you hear this mishmash of stuff. He doesn't even have the birth of Jesus. Wait a minute. He doesn't even mention the guy's father, Joseph. So here's a guy who just appears. When was he born? How was he born? Anything special about that? Nothing said. And so it's an enigma. It's a puzzle. And I think the author's intention was to sift readers in a sieve, so to speak, and see who's going to fall through. And believe it or not, I think a lot of pious modern readers missing Mark's point fall through. And they think it's just a kind of prelude to the glorious gospel of Matthew and Luke, which clearly make Jesus more exalted.
We've looked at the date of composition for Mark, the arguments, you know, for the various categories before 70 and after 70. And we found that you've got the majority of scholars, 61% of those opining think that Mark was written pre-70 or no later than 70. Okay. And then so that's the majority position for the date of composition. And then for authorship, we've got a 2-to-1 ratio of scholars, critical scholars, writing in English since 1965. Your sampling of 207, quite robust. 2-to-1 ratio saying that the traditional authorship of Mark or John Mark is correct versus those who would say it's not correct or probably not correct. And then this third one dealing with the Petrine connection, again, a 3-to-1 ratio, 2-to-1 ratio, 2-to-1 ratio who say that Peter was either Mark's source or one of Mark's sources.
Yes.
For the gospel.
Well, Justin's research, I think, is valuable. I would want to commend him for it. I think he spent uncounted hours telling this material. The problem is his definition of critical scholars and the methods that each one uses. It's one thing to tally up what people say, and some people would just say, we don't know. And others would say, well, you know, the only name we have is Mark. So that could well be Mark in the Book of Acts. But again, when somebody says it could well be, you've got to pause and say, but why would you make that connection? If you go to Papias, that really, if you look at that passage carefully in Eusebius from the 4th century, is not very confidence building in terms of any kind of apostolic authority. In fact, it's kind of a mess. You do the best you can as you remember, but you don't put anything fulsome. So I feel like what Josh did is worthwhile, and I would be interested in seeing the tables that he came up with. They did mention that. Any kind of work like that is good work, and I'm sure he learned a lot, and he seems like a really good guy, good student. The flaw might be the way it was set up. We're going to do critical scholars with a PhD as if that's the ticket for discussing a topic, and it's almost just like, which way is the wind blowing? You know, and I don't know that that really helps. But I bet he learned a lot in going through the all the arguments. But there's always this apologetic edge to it, and that's what bothers me. It doesn't seem to be neutral. You notice at the end, Mike is kind of triumphant. Well, I'll just put my own name in since he didn't name me. Let's hope that scholars like Tabor and Ehrman and Crossan will quit saying that most scholars doubt that Mark wrote Mark. That seemed to be the whole point of the study.
You can distrust what the Gospel of Mark reports, but you shouldn't use the arguments against the traditional authorship of Mark and that he got his information from Peter. You probably shouldn't use those because the evidence suggests that John Mark was the author. Peter was at least, at very minimum, one of his sources, if not the main source, and that this is the position of the majority of critical scholars today, writing in English since 1965 by a 2-to-1 ratio.
And it just, to me, like that kind of polling would change anything that I would say when I'm trying to honestly look at the evidence and weigh it. And we've read these very texts and examine them. I felt a kind of a triumphant cymbal sounding at the end. Nailed it. These guys need to quit saying that most scholars are agreed or most critical scholars. So that's the problem I had.
Excellent. Well, bean counting opinions isn't the best way to learn about Mark anyway. You've got a brand new 7-part lecture series available now called Creating Jesus: Why Was Mark's Gospel Forgotten? That people can sign up for now at tinyurl.com/TaborMark. Tell us about that.
This course on Mark is one that I have taught for 3 decades at 3 different universities, and it's put in 7 lessons. It's college level in the sense that I've taken the material that I use in a college level class, but it's accessible to anybody that wants to take it. There's a study guide. It's substantial with all kinds of notes, readings, maps, and you simply listen to the videos and get guided through. And I think the value of it is you put everything out of your head except Mark as Mark, and you let it work as a document. And I think we owe that to any ancient text. Don't use a text for something else. Let the text be the text. And then once you've done that, you're in a position to make other judgments on that text. So I hope people will dive in. I just find it fascinating. And I think many others will too.
If you're watching this video shortly after it comes out, there's still early bird pricing for the course. But even if you're watching far into the future, it's still available for just the price of a popular book, and not the full university tuition that you'd normally pay for this. Forever access to 4K studio quality recordings. Great information, great deal. And if you use the link tinyurl.com/TaborMark, TaborMark, then you'll also be supporting the work of Paulogia. And I thank you so much for that.
That's great. Well, thank you for the time.
Thank you so much, Dr. Tabor.
Well, you're a very interesting editor, and I appreciate it. Yeah. With all the cartoons and so forth.
For more collaborations with noted scholars helping me take a look at the claims of Christians, tap on the video on screen now, and I'll see you over there. Later.